This is Bounded Top Atari 8-Bit Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Antic, the Atari 8-Bit Podcast. My name is Randy Kindig, and this is a special interview-only episode of Antic. This interview is with Chuck Peavy, who worked on games for the Atari 8-Bit computer like Blue Max, Lode Runner, Fight Night, One-on-One Basketball, Panther, Ace of Aces, and Dark Chamber. We had a great conversation about his days programming the Atari, and I hope you enjoy it. This interview was recorded via Skype on October 4th, 2014.
So you live in California right now, right?
I do. I live in Orange County.
Is that where you've always lived?
No, I was born in Logan, Utah. We moved around a lot.
Okay.
So I don't think I lived in the same place for more than 3 years until after I got out of the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
So I was about 20. And, well, technically even then I moved around a lot locally, but I was living in Utah when I was doing the video games. I did a lot of my work was for Sculptured Software.
Okay. Okay. So how did you get started with programming games? And you said you were in the Navy.
Yeah, well, you know, I was thinking about that the other day because I made a connection I hadn't made before. So when I was 14 in junior high school, I remember my science teacher talking about how scientists got to work with punch cards and run these programs on these big old complex computers. And I thought the computers were cool. And I thought telling a computer what to do was even cooler. So at 14, I decided I wanted to be a scientist. And so I was born in 61. So that's what, 74, 75. I decided I wanted to be a scientist so I could work with computers. Because back then, unless you were a humongous corporation, you couldn't have a computer. And, you know, time went on. I joined the Navy when I was 17. I went advanced electronics. I wasn't raised in a wealthy environment, so I was going to have to find my own way to pay for college. And, hell, I wasn't even raised in a middle-class environment. So I still had to find my own way to college. So I joined the Navy. I'd taken their entrance exam. I passed all but like two questions. I only failed two questions, and the recruiter was excited. And I understand why now, because I was like an extra bonus for him. But he got me in the advanced electronics program, and I learned how to work on electronics. I mean, this was back then. They were still switching over to digital. None of the stuff that I learned. Well, I learned about transistors. That was the most advanced thing I'd learned about. There were no microprocessors. There were no anything. And then I got out and started working a job. Before there were computers, there were these things called character generators that people used to subtitle the news. So, you know, it's like accident or, you know, the name of the reporter or whatever, that was done with a character generator. And I worked for the company, one of the companies that manufactured character generators. While I was working that job, the Commodore 64 computer came out and I started fiddling around with it. So that's kind of where it started.
Okay. Of course, in those days, they, you know, there weren't really people coming out of college that knew how to program games, right?
Oh,
or programming.
I tried to get into college. I actually talked to three different colleges, and I'm like, I was already programming a little bit in assembly language and a lot in BASIC on the Commodore. Mm-hmm. In fact, I was working on this idea I had. I was into bodybuilding a little bit, and I was designing a program that was a nutritional guide. And so I talked to BYU, Utah State University, and another one I can't remember the name of, trying to get some kind of a of a computer science degree. And every one of them was like, well, you're going to study Fortran, you're going to study COBOL, and we might come out with C as an elective in about 3 years, so you'll probably get to take C as an elective in your senior year. It's like, right. I don't want to do that. I don't want to learn Fortran and COBOL. Those are boring languages that are about to die. And I remember one of the admissions people got really angry with me when I told them that COBOL was on its way out. You know, because they just, well, obviously they'd built a whole curriculum about it. So I just learned it on my own. I had a couple of friends and we'd sit around and we'd program together and exchange ideas.
So how old were you when you were doing this?
Like 21, 22.
Okay. Maybe. So how did you get your first job actually programming games? How did that come about?
I actually published the nutritional guide. It was called The Nutritionist, and the publisher was a company called, I think it was Nanosec. It was Nanosec. It was a couple of German guys who lived in Ogden, and they started a little publishing company. I sold like 100 copies because they were really a little publisher. Atari, they were not. And that was on the Commodore 64, but it was a really good program. And then I went to work for a company called iOmega. I don't know if you remember them. So,
did they make hardware?
They made removable hard drives.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah, I remember.
And they're the ones who created the Zip drive and the Jazz drive that were really big in the 90s. So this was in the 80s. I went to work for them in their test engineering department. There's a whole freaking story there that's about corporate stupidity. But while I was working for them, then they were struggling. I got a phone call from George Mitos at Sculptured Software, and he said, hey, you know, I saw The Nutritionist. I like the code. Do you want to come write games for me? And, it'd be purely contract and so on. And I was feeling pretty upset at iOmega. It was yet another corporate job that after I'd gone in and helped them out, added me to the list of people they didn't need anymore. So I thought, you know what? Contract's the way to go because I get to pick my clients. I get to pick my projects. So, yeah, I started working for George. I started doing contracts for him.
So you were doing that out of your home?
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, okay. I think by now it was 1986. Let's see. Yeah, it was about 86. I started working for George or for Sculptured Software. I started doing contracts for them.
So, did you write any Atari software while you were at Sculptured Software? I believe you did, right?
Yeah, most of it was. The first thing I worked on was a conversion of Ace of Aces to the Atari XE.
Okay.
So Atari was sending us a lot of work that was conversions to the XE. And the funny thing was, they didn't have much Atari code. They had lots of Apple code. So, because some of these had already come out on the Atari. So they were sending me Apple code and saying, all right, convert this to run out of a cartridge on the Atari XE. And that's what I started doing. So it was really great work for me because I got to kind of look over the shoulders of some really great coders.
So, okay. So how long did you work for Sculptured Software?
Like I say, everything I did for them was contracts. So technically I wasn't an employee of theirs, but I think I was almost exclusive with them till about 1989. The last project I did for Sculptured was Dark Chambers. And that was kind of 100% from scratch kind of thing. Oh, that's right. And then I worked on, I wasn't the last thing. I worked on Missing in Action for the Atari 7800, which was killed 1 week before it was finished, I think because the company that we wrote it for went under. So that was disappointing, too, because I was going to get a royalty on that one.
Right. Okay.
I don't know if you've seen Missing in Action.
I have. I know there were some YouTube videos that showed that game. It was based on Chuck Norris, I believe, right?
Right. Yeah, it was based on all three of the Chuck Norris movies. We kind of went through all three of them. Interesting little side note from that. That's one of the first games where we had an artist and a programmer. Well, pretty much anything that I did, they had to give me an artist, because as an artist, I was a really awesome coder. They actually tried to make me do some of my own art early on, and they decided against it real quick.
They learned that wasn't your main skill. Huh?
No, to this day, I can cut and paste, and I can, you know, do some shading stuff, but you don't want to get me doing art ever.
Okay.
So I was actually really surprised to find out that somebody had gotten a hold of a beta version of Missing in Action, and it's out in the wild. People are actually playing it on emulators.
Yeah, that's what I saw. I think that's what the YouTube video was based on. And then I think there was an Atari Age forum discussion where somebody actually released the program.
I'll tell you what sucks is I actually had in my possession a final burned into ROMs.
Oh, really?
And somebody stole a box when I was moving. Somebody stole a box that had my Commodore 64 computer and that and some other things in it that were really...
Oh, wow.
I mean, like, stuff I'll never get back. I had a ROM burner in there. I had source code for a bunch of my games. Mm-hmm. It's all just gone.
I'm surprised that cartridge has never shown up on eBay or something. Maybe the person's afraid that... it'll give him away.
Odds are they didn't even know what they were grabbing. I think happened is I'd stacked a bunch of stuff up next to a truck and gone in for another load. And it was a few weeks later I realized that box wasn't there. So I'm sure that somebody took it while I was running back in for another load.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't care. They got themselves an old computer. And I mean, they don't know what's on that cartridge. For one thing, the cartridge wouldn't play on a Commodore 64. It would only play on the 7800. And the 7800 was in a different box, which I still have that.
So they probably found that cartridge, tried to use it on the Commodore 64, and realized it didn't work.
And then tossed it.
Yeah.
And if they even recognized what it was, it had like a long cable coming off of it. And, the little zip ROM holders, you know, the ones that you can flip the switch down on. Mm-hmm. It was a pretty cool little setup.
Okay, so while you were at Sculptured Software, you worked on Dark Chambers.
Right.
And you worked on MIA. And you said Ace of Aces?
Yeah, so the first one I did, I'm pretty sure, was Ace of Aces. Then... I think the second thing they threw at me was Loadrunner. Loadrunner was second or third. One-on-one basketball was in there somewhere. So I think it was Loadrunner, and then it was one-on-one basketball was the order it ran. Loadrunner was a nightmare to port.
Was it?
I mean, Doug Smith is an awesome coder, and the code was clean as hell. But... it was written for the Apple, so the Apple doesn't have sprites.
Right, exactly.
And the Apple has memory, and it maps memory to the video card. And I have to be a little vague because it's been so long since I've worked on this code that there's things I don't exactly remember. But what he did is he had a section of memory that was a 256-byte chunk of memory that was all Fs. And then he would overlay that with his graphics to do like a exclusive OR so that the graphics would overlay into the background. So I had to convert all that over to the way that the Atari would do it. That was hard.
Yeah, that would be, I mean, basically it would be rewriting that part
and
of it.
I'm pretty sure that's the first time I ran into self-modifying code that was really used in a program. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with that term?
Yeah, oh yeah.
So, yeah, that was a big thing on the Commodore 64. And you know, like I say, I learned a lot. That's also the only Atari game that I got my name on.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. So I was so excited because LoadRunner was one of my top games. Doug Smith was like a god to me, you know? So the fact that I got LoadRunner, if he wouldn't have told me, he had like three things sitting on his desk. And if he wouldn't have told me LoadRunner, I would have begged him for LoadRunner. But he gave me LoadRunner. And what I did is I changed the home screen so that it says Atari XE version by Chuck Peavy at the bottom right corner. That was one of the first things I put into it. So Atari saw it right from the start. Well, I don't know, about 2 months after they mastered it, I get a call from Atari and they're like, hey, how'd you get your name into our masters? And I said, my name's been on there the whole time. See, Atari didn't want anybody to know who did them because Atari didn't want anybody to know who their coders were.
They didn't want to get hired away, did they?
It probably kept us cheap.
Right.
You know, back then we didn't make a lot of money for writing video games. Uh-huh. It was, I mean, I made a living at it, but it wasn't like what you can make now. It was no six-figure job, that's for sure.
Right.
But yeah, so I said, well, you know, my name's always been on there. I assumed if you guys didn't say no early on, you were okay with it. And he calls me up a day later and he says, yeah, we looked, your name's been on every single copy. He says, well, don't do it again. I said, dude, my name's on LoadRunner. I don't need it anywhere else.
Yeah, that is certainly one of the top games ever for the Atari XE. So, that had to be quite something to work on.
You know, I mean, even before that, we played it. Me and my friends played it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was fun just to watch and see how your other friends would get through the maze.
Yeah.
You know, we drink beer and cheer. It was...
So, speaking of Doug Smith, I mean, he recently passed away. Did you keep up with him? Were you friends over the years? Or
I never met the guy.
Okay.
All I did is, I saw his code. Mm-hmm. And one of the things about reading somebody else's code is it's really personal. I feel like I knew him in a way because I know how he codes. It's like I know how his mind thinks. But, yeah, I never actually got to meet him.
Okay. Yeah, I wasn't sure whether you had or not.
You know, I did meet Scott Adams, though.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. You know who he is, right?
Yeah, how did that come about?
He'd created some kind of a forum. This is a long, long time ago. And I sent him an email, and he responded to me, and we chatted back and forth a bit. It was kind of fun. So, yeah, he was just working on some, this is like 97, 98, so he was working on some new ideas and some new things, and so was I. So it was just nice, you know, to hit and run. We didn't stay in touch or anything. I'm sure if I reached out to him again or if he reached out to me, I'd, you know, but he was also somebody who was a big deal to me because I loved his adventure games. Just yes. Loved them. Adventureland was so much fun.
A lot of people really were into his games. So you said you worked on Dark Chambers, which was a dungeon action adventure dungeon game.
Right. It was based on Dandy, which was the predecessor to Gauntlet. So
was Dark Chambers a port from some other platform, or was that written specifically?
No, it was clean. That was like right from scratch code. So it was based on the concept of Dandy, but how it came together and everything. I mean, I worked with a producer on that one who kind of helped shape the direction and the maps, but as far as the coding and everything, I wrote all that code from line one.
You also worked on Blue Max. Was that right? Were you with Sculptured Software when you did that?
Yeah, Blue Max was the first one for Sculptured.
Okay, and that was a port.
Yeah, that was a port. It was a pretty easy port.
That was a port from what platform?
I want to say from Apple.
So a lot of the ports you did were from the Apple platform.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think I ever did a port from a Commodore.
Oh, that's what I was wondering.
I did work on Dark Castle for the Commodore 64, which was a port from, I think, a 16-bit Apple.
Oh, like the right? 2GS?
I think so. I wasn't the only coder on that. They had three of us on that. I'm blanking on the other names.
That was with, let's see, well, I don't know. I guess I don't have that information in front of me here. I did some research, but I don't know.
Yeah, I'm seriously blanking. It's kind of cracking me up.
Yeah, if you had done a port from the Commodore, that would have had its own challenges, as I'm sure you're aware, because it does have sprites, but it obviously does it differently than the Atari does.
Yeah, and I did, you know, Commodore 64 was my start.
Yeah.
So I knew my way around the Commodore pretty well. Moving over to the Atari was a little different. It was actually more constrained. There were things you couldn't do on the Atari you could do on the 64. For one thing, your so-called sprites were only two colors. There were four of them. They were two colors. If you wanted to have more colors, you had to overlay them. So you could have four sprites with two colors or two sprites with four colors. But the fourth color was always like the background color. So technically it was three colors. And then you had like four little 2-pixel sprites that you could do whatever you wanted to, including join them. And oddly enough, the sprites ran the whole vertical size of the screen. So if you wanted to move a sprite vertically, you actually moved it within the memory that represented the sprite region. Well, not memory, but you moved the pointer in a register. So Atari sprites were really weird. Commodore sprites, you had 16, they were pretty big. You could do a lot more stuff. So, you know, looking at Dark Chambers, if you notice, there's a whole bunch of... Have you ever played it?
I played it for maybe 5 minutes in preparation for this interview, so I've not played it much.
Okay, so what I did there is I created... are you familiar with what... Well, some of the people listening may not know what an interrupt is. So an interrupt is a thing that tells the microprocessor, stop doing whatever you're doing, your main programmer, and go do this instead for a second and then come back. Okay. So, for example, there's a vertical blank interrupt. So one of the things that the processor is doing is drawing your screen from the top left corner. It draws to the top right corner. Then it goes down to the next line. Each of those horizontal lines, interesting on the Atari, actually, and the Commodore, each of those horizontal lines has an interrupt. And when it gets down to the bottom and it has to go all the way back up to the top, there's another interrupt called the vertical blank interrupt. So one of the things that we do to make things happen in real time is regular code and things we're updating on a regular basis. But when you draw sprites, when you draw graphics, when you do anything like that, you have to draw them during the vertical blank interrupt. So you don't get, you know, flashing on the screen. Another thing that we'll use are horizontal blank interrupts. You don't have as much time. You can execute maybe 5 commands in a horizontal blank, but it's enough to make a color change, for example. Well, one of the things, because the map was so big, I mean, it was huge, there wasn't enough room in memory to do it without putting it on multiple pages. So I created a moving interrupt right in the middle of the map. So the stuff at the top of the map was on one map, and the stuff at the bottom of the map was on a different map. They were literally two different maps. So if you go to the middle of the screen, now the top map could have up to 10 bad guys. So you could have two good guys plus whatever they were shooting and 10 bad guys. And the bottom of the map could have 10 bad guys. So if you're anywhere near the middle, you could have as many as 20 bad guys coming at you at the same time.
That's interesting that you remember all those details.
Well, those were the things that were hard to figure out and the most fun to figure out. Mm-hmm. So, and the bad guys are actually character graphics. They're actually part of the background.
Hmm. Okay.
Wow, is this getting too technical?
No, that's fine. I'm actually from a programming background myself, and I did some programming on the Atari, although not as much as you did. But, yeah, I know what you're talking about. I don't know. You know, some of our listeners are not going to be as familiar, but, you know, I think that's fine.
Well, basically, I you got to think with an interrupt is it's like, you know what it'd be like? It's like, say you're driving down the road and you get a text and you're a good driver, so you pull over to answer your text and then you get back on the road. That text experience would be an interrupt, a vertical blank interrupt, a horizontal blank interrupt. And, you know, you're back to doing your regular task. And then if you get another one, you pull over and you handle it. The new processors are multi-threaded. So one process doesn't necessarily have to stop. It'll start up another one for some kind of an interrupt. Mm-hmm. But back then, they were linear. They only did one piece of code at a time. So it had to shove this little piece of code it was working on over into a pile, execute the new code, and when that was done, it would come back.
So you also worked on Fight Night.
Yes.
Was that while you were with Sculptured Software?
It was.
Okay. Anything you remember specifically about that game?
I hated it.
Okay. Why did you hate it?
You know, that had drop menus. That was one of the first games that had drop menus. I mean, that stuff was innovative when you think about it. They didn't even have drop menus and word processors back then.
Right.
Uh-huh. In fact, there were a lot of things that we did in video games that would magically show up in like WordStar and stuff like that later. And they were blatant about it. They would actually steal the code outright. It would run exactly the same way. It's like, okay. I mean, I'm sure they weren't like just copying our code and pasting it in, but you know, they would look at it and say, oh, that's how they do that. So they'd do it the exact same way. But yeah, so Fight Night had those drop menus, which were really difficult to work with. Partly because I had to make this run in a cartridge. And a cartridge isn't RAM, it's ROM. It means you can't make changes in it. And Fight Night was a pig. It used a lot of space. I think I had to do it on a double ROM. So it's one of the few ones that was extra big.
And that's a bare knuckle fighting game.
Yes, it was pretty fun. I remember that. It was fun to play, but yeah, it was a pain to program. I block part of that out.
I bet it would be. I mean, trying to have people punching at each other and detecting when they're hitting each other and how much force, and I mean, I'm sure that wasn't easy.
You know, well, because it's a conversion, I mean, a lot of that code was already written. I just had to go in and make it actually run.
Right.
But sometimes that meant rewriting that section. So what you do is you go in and you study what the guy did and how he made it work, and then you figure out what resources you have available, and then you rewrite it so it works the same way on the new machine. And you know, like I say, that was part of the fun for me, was trying to figure out how to make something else try and make something do what it needed to do. You know, so yeah, it's funny, I don't remember much about Fight Night. I can tell you an interesting story about one-on-one basketball though.
Okay, great. Yeah, I was wanting to talk about that one next.
Oh, perfect timing then. So, you know, Eric Hammond was a huge fan of Dr. J and Larry Bird.
Okay.
Huge fan. And when I got this thing, I actually got, it's one of the few that I got that I actually got an executable version. And I had the little manual in there, and he's talking about what he did. And what he did is at one point, he actually had those two guys in his room sitting on his bed looking over his shoulder while he was coding.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
So, you know, they went out and shot some hoops together, which I'm sure was a big thrill for him. And then he got to sit down and he got to show off his code. Well, by this point, I had done a lot of these conversions, so I was starting to get really clear on how people think when they code. And I think I can tell you exactly when they were there. Because there's this one section of code. It wasn't well documented. It had loopbacks. It had self-modifying code like crazy. It was making calls to places it should have never made calls to and then making calls back. It was like it was like a moment of crazy code.
So it's like he wasn't really focused on the programming.
I think like. What he was doing, I mean, you know, you say you've coded, you probably know. I think he went into ultra geek mode.
Yeah.
I think he was like, oh, and look, I can do this, and I can do, and then I can do this, and this is self-modifying code, and then this changes this, and it makes this change, and then this happens, and it makes, you know, and yeah, that bit of code was a struggle. I'm pretty sure, I mean, it was good code. It's what we called back in the day kludgy code, and but it definitely got the job done. It's just all this code through the whole game was awesome. And then there was this little thing, and I just can't help but think that he wrote that with somebody with, you know, his idols looking over his shoulder. I could be completely wrong, and he wants to punch me out for that. But that little bit of code, I just look at that, and I remember looking at that, and I'm going, that's not his normal coding style.
Maybe he was doing the coding right in front of them, and just trying to show off a little bit.
That's what I think. I think he was showing off. If I was showing off, I would have done the same thing he did.
Yeah. Well, I will tell you, that game is the one that I am most familiar with of all the games that you worked on. I remember this game a lot because my son and I used to play it a lot on the Atari.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. I when he wanted a game machine, I said, nope, I'll get you a computer. You can play games on it, but you can do other stuff as well.
Right.
This was certainly one of the games that we had to play on that. So, and we were big basketball fans. So, yeah, I really remember and love this game.
And that game was so much fun. You know, it was a fun game to play. And you know, if you did a jump shot just right, you'd break the backboard, and a goofy little guy'd come out and sweep up the glass.
Yes,
it's hilarious.
That. Yeah.
And I remember the actual code, he kind of coded in a little bit about their playing styles. So Dr. J was better at the inside game, and Larry Bird was better at the outside game.
Right.
And that was built into the game. And when you think about it, I mean, that original was 1983. That's phenomenal. That's phenomenal that he figured all that stuff out that early on.
Yeah, it's a pretty awesome game for when it was built. There's no doubt about that. So you also worked on Panther, right? For sculpture software.
Yes, I worked on that. That was Panther was one of the Mastertronic games, which were kind of like the cheap game bin. Mm-hmm. It was mostly Mastertronic stuff, but Panther was a big hit, and Peter Adams was working on it. Then they asked me to give him a hand. Peter Adams is the guy who did Zaxxon. I think the Commodore 64 version of Zaxxon. And they asked me to give him a hand working on it. So I did a lot of the collision stuff. Are you familiar with the game?
Yeah, a little bit. Mm-hmm.
You know, you got to land next to these little bunkers and the people run out.
Right.
So I had to get the kind of the collision stuff working for the people to come out of the bunkers and run into the ship. I had to get the counters and things like that going. Peter had already written the core engine. It's an isometric scroll, isometric 3D, which means you kind of play in 2D space, but the screen's moving on a 45-degree angle, so it emulates 3D space, which is what Zaxxon was in a way. Well, and Ace of Aces, same kind of thing.
Right, right. I noticed the similarity with Ace of Aces.
Yeah, so, a lot of that stuff had already been written before I got involved. Now, I talked earlier about the interrupts, the vertical blank and the horizontal blank interrupts and sprite sizes. So I think you get three or four saucers come after you at any particular time. I think it's four, because I think there's five things that I had to sort. So what happens is these saucers are out there and they're flying in this pattern, and Peter had created the pattern and gotten the saucers working. But the problem is you need to know how close to the ground they are. So we have to have a shadow on the ground. So Atari has four sprites. We have four bad guys coming at us. So I'm pretty sure that we use that multi-piece sprite for our spaceship. Anyway, for our guy, the good guy. And then, so you got the, honestly, I don't remember. It's a long time ago. It's either three or four. I'll just say four. So you got the four saucers that are flying at you. Then underneath those four saucers, you have four shadows, one for each ship. Which, if you think about it, it's a problem, because how do you do that? You've only got four whole sprites. Well, what you do is you create a horizontal blank interrupt after the ship. You figure out the vertical position of the shadow, and then you draw the shadow. You draw the shape of the ship as a shadow on the ground. That's what you have to do. Only problem is that the code to do that was humongous. It was it was actually like using up the whole time it took to draw a screen. So one of the things I had to do was rewrite that. And it sounds minimal, and it kind of is. But I spent probably about 3 days on just that piece of code, the piece of code to draw those shadows. And I got it from taking somewhere in the neighborhood of 3,000 machine cycles to executing in 126.
Wow, that's quite an improvement.
Yeah, it was something else. I was pretty proud of that code.
But so was it the exact same method that was used with Ace of Aces as well? Because it has the same.
No. Okay. Ace of Aces was different. And if you look at Ace of Aces, there aren't really as many things coming at you. Mm-hmm. In fact, on Ace of Aces, you've got what, like one airplane coming at you. That's it.
Right.
I don't think I've ever seen two. If there are two, there's no more than two. And then, you got everything else is on the ground. You got the bridges that you bomb, the ships, that kind of thing. Ace of Aces didn't have that complicated of a thing going for it. It's those damn spaceships in Panther that were tough. And that was one of those pieces of code that I'm particularly happy with, because it was just, there was no way to shave even another cycle from that. It couldn't have gotten smaller.
And you say that code had to execute in the VBI?
Yes.
Okay.
So we had to execute the sort in the VBI, and then we had to execute the result of the sort in the horizontal blank. So, we had to figure out the position of all the ships in 3D space, so to speak. Then we had to sort them so that regardless of if it's ship 1, 2, 3, or 4, it's which ship is the highest. Which ship is the furthest back in 3D space and which is the highest in the air, so that we got which shadow had to be drawn first. So the shadow for ship number one might be drawn from the sprite for ship number three.
Hmm.
You get what I'm saying?
I think so.
Because we're emulating 3D space. So the ships, wherever they are, it's all about height. how high is the shadow, or which shadow's the lowest on the screen and which shadow's the highest. Well, the highest shadow has to be drawn first, the second highest is second, third highest is third, fourth highest is fourth. So you had to know those things so that you knew which one to draw first. And then you drew it with whichever sprite became available first. So there you go.
Wow. Sounds like it took a lot of work to get that one working well.
That was, well, you know, I mean, one thing about coding games back in those days, if you didn't enjoy sitting there, not doing anything but staring at code. you ever see the movie The Music Man?
You know what? I don't think I've ever seen that one, no.
It's funny. The mayor says, I haven't seen anything so exciting since that wrestling match where they lay on the mat without moving a muscle for 3 hours. God, that was exciting. And it's the anticipation, which one's shoulders are going to hit the mat first. You know what I mean? Well, that's what this coding is like. It's like you just, when, you know, we didn't have the space to waste or the machine right. cycles to waste like we do now.
Everything had to be very, very efficient.
Oh my gosh. I still write really clean code, but it's sloppy compared to my old standards.
Yeah. Well, you don't have to be as efficient anymore. You've got
right.
so much memory, so many cycles, you know, so the CPUs are so fast. Nobody worries about efficiency that much anymore.
Which kind of sucks because I run into a lot of code that's really horrible.
Yeah. Oh,
it's yeah. like, come on, you really need to throw everything into this object?
Right. Why not? It won't hurt anything, right?
Because every object's a gigabyte now, you know? It's like, hey.
Right. So Panther just only came out on tape, right? Only on cassette?
No, it was on disc.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Yeah, I actually have the case for the Panther, the disc version.
Okay.
So, yeah, I'm pretty sure that was... I didn't even know it was on tape, so I guess it must come out on both.
I guess when I think of Mastertronic, I think of tape games, but...
They did a lot of tape games.
Yeah.
But in the later 80s, everything was moving to disc.
Sure. And it's not a big deal to move from tape to disc, so I'm sure it was available on disc.
Yeah, it's not, you're right, because, you know, it's just a different medium. You just got to copy it up there.
Right. So, did you work at any other place besides Mastertronic? Or, you know, besides Sculptured Software, you were doing contract work for them. Did you work anywhere else after that? Working on games?
I'm trying to think. So there was a company called Baton Technologies. You know, it was interesting. I went to the Consumer Electronics Show. I think this was 1991. It's when the NES, not the NES, NEC, had a 16-bit machine they were coming out with. And Sega had the Genesis that they were coming out with. And I went and I talked to both of them. And Sega was awesome. Sega was like, oh, yeah, you're a developer? Yeah, we definitely want a contract with you. I mean, they gave me a contract to sign right then, like a non-disclosure. So I could learn about and develop on their platform. And then I went over to NEC and they're like, well, you know, if you want to do business with us, you can only go through these specific companies and you have to work with them. And some of those companies were really struggling financially. So I was like, well, that's interesting. So it was kind of interesting to see how Sega was, yes, we'll embrace anybody. And NEC was like, we don't want to work with anybody. And in the end, look who won.
Right.
Because a lot of people haven't even heard of the NEC.
Right.
So anyway, I got kind of licensed by Sega to develop on their platform and was kind of putting the word out. And this company called Baton Technologies got a hold of me. And they had designed a modem, a 2400 baud modem that would plug into the slot on the Commodore 64. Or I'm sorry, the Sega Genesis. So what they wanted me to do was help them get to the next consumer electronics show with the working modem. Just be able to make it so that we could demonstrate that the modem worked. So the idea was through the modem, I think we did like kind of a ripoff of Ace of Aces. And it was just through the modem, make it so that from one computer, you could move the controller and it would move the airplane on the other computer over the modem. And then they also wanted to do like a, you know, command line interface for the modem. So I built both of those. I was working long, late nights over Christmas and everything because CES is in January. And we got to the show and we were able to show it off. Mm-hmm. And not long after that, I went to work on a project for Sega. I'm trying to decide if I'm allowed to talk about it. I guess this many years out, I probably am. I was working on a title that was based on the Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote. And the company that I was working with had problems and the whole thing just kind of dumped. So, but I still got the design. It was an awesome game design. It was kind of along the lines of, you know, the Roadrunner was going to be like really fast, kind of like Sonic the Hedgehog. And Wile E. Coyote was setting Rube Goldberg type traps for him that he'd have to get past.
Okay. Did you do any other Atari computer development after you left?
I didn't do the last thing I did for the Atari that was published was Dark Chambers, and then of course Missing in Action that didn't happen.
Okay, so that was kind of the end of the line for your Atari 8-bit development.
Right, and I went on, I did X-Files for the PlayStation, and then I quit doing video games entirely, and now I do web development.
So what did you like and not like about doing game development for the Atari?
There's not much I did not like. I really, really liked working on the 6502 microprocessor. It was so much fun. And, you know, just having this small set of words, I think it's 156 commands, and you're able to do so much, being able to tell a computer what to do. You know, in the movie The Matrix, there's a point where Keanu Reeves is talking to that guy that ultimately betrayed him. He's like, yeah, they're looking at the computer screens. And the guy goes, yeah, he goes, I don't even see the code anymore. All I see is like blonde, brunette, redhead. When you write video games, as I'm typing the code, I'm visualizing what's going to happen in my head. I really didn't see the code anymore. All I saw was, so that little line from The Matrix really jumped out at me. All I ever saw was what was going to show up on the screen or what the sound was going to sound like. And we'd visualize it like that. And I love the community. The people that I worked with were awesome because we were kind of pioneers. We were working together. We were learning things together. You know, you had to keep maybe the title of the project you were working on confidential and some of the details of it. But believe me, we shared ideas all the time. Mm-hmm. It'd be like, hey, I'm having a little problems trying to get this to happen. Oh, well, I wrote a routine that does this, this, and this, and it works like this. And, you know, sometimes we'd even share code. I remember giving somebody a piece of code that I used for to scroll a screen on a Commodore 64. I don't even remember what game that went into, but, you know, he used a small piece of it and vice versa. He helped me out a few times. But there were a lot of things that were great about working on the platform. I wish it was a little faster.
Sure. But, it wasn't any slower than any of the other computers you were working on, right?
No, I just, you know, the one thing that I regret with Dark Chambers is that when I do get 20 monsters on there, it slows down a lot.
Right.
It's running at about 6 frames a second when it's a fully loaded screen. It'd be nice if that could run at 10 or 12. So a little faster would have been nice, but I thought better to slow down a little and have more monsters. I think that people would have enjoyed, you know, I think people like the idea of having, you know, 15, 16 monsters thrown at them instead of a slightly faster game with six.
Right. So the very first time you had to either write the game for the Atari or port one, how did you go about learning about the special features that the Atari had versus, you know, whatever platform it was coming from?
Well, I'd been working on the Commodore, so moving to the Atari was definitely different. I mean, it had different registers and different commands to do things. I picked up a book. Same book everybody else had.
Was it Day Ray Atari?
Maybe. Did they have like a picture of the Atari logo in line art or something? I don't think it was Day Ray Atari. It was something else. It was like just...
The technical reference notes, maybe?
That's it, the technical reference. Atari technical reference.
Yeah, that's a great book for that sort of thing. Okay. So that was really how you learned about the special features that the Atari had that maybe were different from the other machines?
Yeah, I mostly just, you know, I already knew the 6502 code and everything. I just need to know where to put stuff on the Atari.
Right.
That was it.
Yeah, at least it helped that it was the same processor.
Yes.
That would definitely make it more challenging. Do you have any particularly interesting stories around any of the stuff that you worked on that you haven't already shared? Or
Interesting stories. Yeah, one that might be kind of interesting about working on the Missing Action game. I just had another one pop into my head that's a little different, but it wasn't anything I worked on. I'll tell you that one first, cause that's kind of interesting. So somebody was working on a pool game, and, the artist who was doing the artwork for it got this idea that he wanted to try and work with a live model. So we had my little sister come in and play some pool, and he took some pictures of her, and then he actually rotoscoped those pictures. I'm pretty sure that's the first time anybody rotoscoped. And that was like 1987, 88.
Uh-huh.
But, so on the Missing in Action one, what was interesting, and it's part of the reason why I knew we were in trouble. I had the game pretty much running. It was at what we call alpha. So alpha means all the features work and we're starting to tie them together into a plausible game that runs, you know, actual count of points and stuff didn't necessarily work. The hero may not have gone through a full dead sequence. He probably just died or the game stopped or something. Yeah, you know, that kind of stuff. So now from alpha, it's time to tie things together. And then my definition of beta is, as far as I'm concerned, the game's 100%. It's done. It's finished. And now the publisher's reviewing it and finding any problems they need me to fix. I got the thing running, and the publisher came back and said they didn't like the way the controls worked, and they wanted them rewritten. Well, the controls were the center of the whole thing. I mean, it was all karate fighting and shooting stuff. So I literally built all the animation around what commands you did. So he made me gut the program. I was still young enough, I didn't realize that in making me gut the program, I should have made him extend the contract or something, or at least made it clear to him that it was going to extend the time it took. It took me like 3 weeks to rewrite all the controls.
I would imagine.
And then when I got the controls completely rewritten, he says, yeah, I don't like that either.
Oh.
And I go, well, what do you mean? He goes, well, you know, to tell you the truth, I don't like these kind of games, so I'm not going to like any of them.
He could have told you that up front, couldn't he?
I was like, but the other control was better. I think people who play these kind of games would have liked the other control better, but there's no way I'm reverting back. I mean, the code was, I'd made too many changes in the code. So, that was a little frustrating.
So did you ever get specs for these games when you were asked to write one? Or obviously a conversion, they pretty much wanted you to make it work the same, right, as it did on the other platform.
Was that pretty much your spec? Yeah, Dark Chambers is probably a good example of what I might get for a spec. So what I got was it's got to have 26 levels. It's got to have two players. You got a gun. You got bombs. I think you got a knife. Did you get a knife? I think we got a knife. I don't know what the knife did, but we had one. Anyway, or maybe that was it. Maybe it wasn't a gun. Maybe you threw your knife. But I know that when you play the game, a knife shows up on the screen for some reason. So, I think that was like, it was a throwing knife. And then what happened is you found a gun, and then that became more of a rapid fire thing. And then you could find bombs. And okay, the bombs, there's an interesting story. So, you know, it's a single button joystick. So when you're playing, you push the button to shoot the gun. You double click the button to make the bomb go off. So I sat an interval for the double click that I thought worked out well. And the producer I was working with liked it, you know, in-house. And we'd send it to Atari. And back in those days, you had to FedEx this stuff all the time. Well, I'd send it to them. We'd wait a couple days and then hear back. And, oh, they didn't like it. They wanted me to adjust this, or they wanted me to adjust that. Oh, and then there was a color adjustment. So this is like at final. We're just right at final. There's one little color they're trying to get me to change. It's like a slightly different green. And then there's this button click thing, and I'm like, well, this sucks. So we go through about five of those. So it takes about 2 weeks, and we just don't make any progress. And then I just got this idea. I wrote some debug code where you could go in and set the delay interval for the second click and all that stuff. And then I wrote another screen where they could go in and pick whatever color they wanted. And I sent that to them. And then they were like, okay, these are the numbers we like. And they gave me that. And it was done.
Oh, there you go. That was a good idea.
And then, although actually, and I think on that game, we also got to the point, because this was getting just to be crazy, we also started sending the files back and forth by modem. So they'd set a computer up to take an FTP, and I'd modem the files to them. So it would take a couple of hours of uploading versus shipping it. So things, and that was one of the first time that Atari had ever done that with a game.
So did you actually have Ataris in your home that you were doing the development on?
Yeah, so my main machine by that point was an Atari ST.
Okay.
And I had the hardware background, which was handy. And I had a cross compiler, which means it would compile 6502 code on my 68,000 microprocessor computer. I could compile the 6502 code. And what I did is I built a box that plugged into, I think it was a parallel port, and I put a switch on the box. So it plugged into the parallel port, and on the side were two joystick ports, and out the back were two joystick ports. And I ran the two joystick ports out the back and plugged them into the joystick ports on the Atari 8-bit. And I plugged joysticks into the two ports on the left. What I could do is I could flip a switch, and I could use the joystick ports to download code into the Atari. And then I'd flip the switch back, and I could play the game.
Okay. Interesting.
And that was my little homemade development system.
So you cross-compiled on the ST, but how did you actually test it?
So in the Atari, I had this little bit of code that read the joystick ports for a specific command. And I would boot that up. I think I'd boot that up off of a floppy drive. So I turn it on. It would boot up. The 8-bit Atari would display, you know, waiting for code. And then when I'd send the code over, it would read the code in, and then it would execute the code immediately, so the game itself would come up on the display.
Okay, I gotcha.
So basically it was big Atari connected to little Atari, and that was my development system.
Yeah. Did you have like one of each of the different platforms, like the 800, the XE, and the XL, or were you targeting just like the XE?
Well, I just had the XE because anything I needed to do on the other machines, I could do on that.
Okay.
So anything that ran on the XE ran on the other machines. Well, within memory limits. I mean, my XE was the 130, so I had to be careful to make sure everything I wrote ran on the smaller one. But
that would have been, okay, you had the 130 XE.
Right. It's double the memory.
Yeah.
And then I had a 7800. I think, and then I had the ST. I think those were all the Ataris I had. And then I had a Commodore 64.
So, Chuck, do you have any vintage computers today?
I still have my ST.
Oh, do you?
I still have my 8-bit Atari, and I still have my 7800.
Wow.
I just don't have my Commodore 64 anymore. Because somebody stole it.
Right, along with that special cartridge.
Yes, they got stuff that's worthless to them that I really miss.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting that you still have. Do you do anything with those Ataris today, or?
No, I keep them in boxes.
Yeah.
But every once in a while, I pull them out. I have all the cartridges for the games that I wrote.
Mm-hmm.
All the floppies are gone. They just died. They lost their magnetism and passed away.
Right.
But, yeah, I still have all my games. To tell you the truth, the ST is probably worthless because I don't have anything that runs on that anymore either. So it was all on floppies.
Yeah, and it doesn't have a cartridge port like the,
right,
like the 8-bits. Yeah, I used to have an ST as well. After the 8-bits, I had the ST. So, okay. Well, that's interesting that you still got those from that day in the day. You don't have any involvement today then with vintage games with games at all. You said you do web development.
I do, and I tried to do some web development in the gaming industry. In fact, I tried to get into E3 a few years back. And they're like, well, you're not directly involved in the video game industry. You're going to have to pay full price. But I wrote all these games. They go, we don't care.
Well, that's nice.
It's like the E3 people could give a damn about somebody like me. It's like, well, you're a has-been. You don't count anymore.
Oh, wow. That's insulting.
I know. That's how I felt. I was like, you know, everything you guys are doing is based on what me and my friends did back in the day.
Yeah, that's true.
In fact, you know what's funny is web development. Websites owe their functionality to the video game industry.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people don't get it, but, you know, think about this for a second. The old video games, did you have to have a manual to figure out how to play them?
Sometimes, if they were complex.
For the most part, not.
Right.
You know, the reality was there was a method for how a video game played. They were intuitive. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, intuitive didn't just come together. It was something that we had to figure out. It was something that we created. It was, what do we want people to think here? One of my pet peeves in a video game was when you'd run up against the edge of a world and you just stop. You shouldn't be forced to be within certain constraints. I mean, there's certain things, for example, on a side scroller. Yeah, you don't want them going back. But, you know, one of the things that we started doing more was allowing you to go back a little ways. And usually you'd have something like there was a rock fall behind you so you couldn't go back. We tried to make it make sense. So one of the things that I do now when I build websites is I still use my video game experience, and I go, how do I make this intuitive? How do I make this so that people don't have to think, they just go where I want them to go?
Yeah, I guess I never really thought about the fact that current websites do, you know, are based on things that were discovered or developed during those days with vintage games.
And even the applications, you know, word processors and spreadsheets and stuff. If you think about it, well, Fight Night's a great example. They were doing drop menus way before anybody else ever did them. I don't know who did drop menus first, but I never saw them before the guy who did Fight Night. So,
okay. Well, did you know that there's a fairly, well, I don't know, I wouldn't say large, but there is a hardcore group of people who are still interested in vintage computers and vintage games?
You know, I had no clue for the longest time, especially after I talked with the E3 people. I'm like, okay, well, nobody gives a damn about us anymore. It's like, you know, being an old soldier. Yeah, I fought in that war. It's like, and I'll tell you something, there was something about video games back then. It was like a war. But kind of a funny story. I went to a party. It's like a private affair, you know, a little wine at a house of some friends of a friend. And I got there, and I try to play it low-key. I'm not very good at that very often, but I sit down, and I start talking with these people, and they're all 20-somethings in college. And, oh, what do you do? Well, I write websites, you know, used to write video games. Oh, what video games? I mentioned Dark Chambers, and this girl just freaks out. You're kidding me. You wrote Dark Chambers. I'm like, what, you know it? She goes, at the same time she says, that's my favorite game, everybody at the table says, that's her favorite game. It turns out everybody there has been over to her house to play Dark Chambers over and over and over again.
Oh, wow.
They sit around, they eat pizza, they drink wine, and they play Dark Chambers.
That had to make you feel pretty good.
It did. I was like, oh my gosh, I've got a fan. Because, you know, after Dark Chambers, that was one of the last ones that Atari did in that run. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember when my son was just barely two, walking into Toys R Us, and of the maybe 10, 12 games hanging on the wall, about 6 or 7 of them were mine. And I was like, this is kind of cool. And I got him, and I go, see, Daddy wrote that one and that one and that one and that one. But Dark Chambers is probably my favorite project ever. I really, really like that one. And Antique Magazine did a great article. They called it Superb. I still have the magazine. I saw it here just the other day. But I never saw it anywhere. I never heard anything. I never got any feedback on it. I never knew anything. And then out of the blue, this girl who I don't think was even born when I made it is telling me how much she loves it.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And that's the first time I'd ever heard anything about any of my games. And then, you know, slowly after that, you know, I had somebody contact me about Missing in Action. They're like, are you the Chuck Peavy who did that? And I'm like, how'd you know about that? And that's when I found out there's a whole cult following to that game. Mm-hmm. Who would have thought? And well, what sucks is it's not even a great version, because it was really, I mean, the finished product was so awesome.
Well, particularly vintage games are really popular these days, you know, much more so even than vintage computers, but yeah, vintage gaming is big. I mean, it just is.
Well, you know what I think it is personally? Because it's a point of frustration that I've had as the industry grew. Everything started to get graphic intensive.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
In 93, I went to work for a company called Park Place Productions. They were based in San Diego area. And oddly enough, they went under about 6 months after I got there. But they were the ones who first started the green screen stuff. They were doing mostly sports games. And they'd done a bunch of the EA Sports games and a bunch of stuff for Sony. Anyway, I remember everything was about graphics and more graphics and how do we make the graphics bigger. And I remember asking about gameplay and they're like, well, you know, we're not worried about that. And this was coming down from Sony and Accolade and all those companies. They weren't that interested in the gameplay. They were interested in getting bigger and better graphics, right, and more complex gameplay. They wanted to, like, you know, they wanted to have more complicated moves in a football game. You know, forget about how easy it is to make those moves. You know, how it is as a controller, as a player, to experience that. They just wanted more graphics. And it still goes on to this day. It's a minefield out there. You'll get like one decent game for every six or seven crappy game that has awesome graphics.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And that's why you'll even find people, like you said, who were not even born when some of these games came out, you know, being interested in those old vintage games, because they are simpler and easier to play and better gameplay and that sort of thing.
And they're fun. You play them with friends, you play them over and over again, you chat, you know. It's like video gaming back then was more social, and now it's more, you know, a couple of guys in a dark room with controllers, you know, let me put it on pause so I can go get a beer.
Yeah, playing over the internet, right?
Playing over the internet, yeah, you know, with the headsets and stuff. It's like, it's right. Crazy. I mean, that's all fun. I'm not knocking it. I think it's all awesome. It's just, there's the thing about the old games for me is that they were just fun to play. It let you use your imagination more. It let you do more skill things. It didn't rely on awesome graphics and awesome graphics alone.
Okay, Chuck, I don't think I had any other questions. I know you had you were wanting to get on the road, I think, so I don't want to take up too much of your time. We've been going for almost an hour and a half. That's unbelievable.
That's crazy. Well, it's been fun. I've really enjoyed this.
Yeah, is there any final thing that you wanted to say to both of our listeners out there?
All two of you? Yeah, give me a call. We'll play. Nah, you know what? I really do appreciate that people appreciate my work, you know? Writing video games was a dream for me. It was a labor of love. And it's nice to know that other people enjoy the stuff that I got to work on.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate your time, and I really enjoyed talking with you.
Thanks. I've enjoyed it, too.
Do you have any links or anything you'd like to provide for the show notes that we put out? Any of your stuff or any websites that you're involved with or anything like that? I'd be happy to put them in the show notes.
Well, you know, nothing that's game related. My web development site is www.unteam. That's U as in universal, N like net, and then team like footballteam.com.
Mm-hmm. Happy to put a link on there to that.
I appreciate that. And if people want to know, I haven't updated it lately, but I need to. I have a blog. It's bgreenjournal.com. Where I talk about, you know, business and environmental stuff from a business perspective. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
So that's something that I kind of redirected some of my energy towards. It's why I'm getting more involved in the environmental community, is because I believe that businesses are the way that we're going to solve this. You know, I think they'll find answers where other people can't. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so those are probably two links that if people want to keep up with me, that's the easiest way to stay up with what I've got going on.
Great. Okay. Well, thanks again, Chuck. Hopefully we'll speak again one day.
That sounds great. I look forward to it, Randy.
All right.
It's been great.
Thanks. See you later.
You bet. Bye.
All right. Bye.